This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's a lot of fine words and backslapping as major players emerge from the G20 meeting in London today. So what did they want going in? Did they get it? And why is it important? Or is it? President Nicolas Sarkozy of France said the agreement on financial regulations represents historic progress. The host, Prime Minister Gordon Brown of Britain, hailed the unprecedented trillion-dollar commitment to the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other global institutions. And President Obama praised the timeliness and magnitude of the response.
We have agreed on a series of unprecedented steps to restore growth and prevent a crisis like this from happening again. Let me outline what I think has been most significant. Number one, we are committed to growth and job creation. All G20 nations have acted to stimulate demand, which will total well over $2 trillion in global fiscal expansion.
All that a far cry from tense disagreements just a few days ago when Germany and France demanded strict regulation of financial markets. President Sarkozy threatened to walk out if that didn't happen. And Chinese leaders worried openly about the value of their U.S. Treasury bonds and wanted to dump the dollar as the world's reserve currency. So, real agreement in London or cosmetics? Why is the G20 important? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk at npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the Japanese-American director of a new movie about a Guatemalan immigrant and a Mexican gangster, Sin Nombre. But first, does the G20 matter? And we begin with Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner and professor of economics at Columbia University in New York. He joins us from the studios there. Nice to have you back on the program.
Nice to be here.
Some of the major players scattered words like historic and unprecedented in those statements as the meeting wrapped up today. Real progress, real compromise, or just cosmetics?
A little of both. I think the commitment to $1 trillion to help the developing countries, something that Gordon Brown emphasized, was historic. The problem is that most of the money is being dispersed through the IMF, and the IMF historical record has not been particularly good. It has pushed policies that are called pro-cyclical that have made downturns into recessions into depressions. It pushed the deregulatory philosophy that has got the world into the mess. The result of this is it does not have the confidence of the developing countries who are the recipients. And so many of them have told me that they'll be on their deathbed before they turn to the IMF. It doesn't bode well. There was a demand for reform of governance, and they are committed. The question is, will it happen fast enough?
And you've also said many times the United States is always happy to talk about tighter financial regulations on financial markets and rarely does anything about it.
That's right. And that's the area where we really don't know the answer. It is important that they all agree to have tighter, comprehensive regulations. But this is an area where cosmetic reforms are particularly easy because the devil's in the detail. A lot of high-sounding words like we'll have oversight of all the institutions. Well, it's nice to know that the hedge funds are registered, but the real question is their behavior being restricted before they get into trouble? And it's not the hedge funds which are really the core of the problem. It's the banks that have been allowed to become too big to fail. And in the United States, we've been consolidating the banks, making them even bigger, too big to fail. We've exacerbated the problem. And there has been no proposal that I've heard to restrict the kind of risk-taking behavior that got us into the mess, at least in a significant way, doing something about the derivatives in a meaningful way. So those are the kinds of questions that are being raised about the regulatory reforms that have been proposed by the administration and obviously the kind of questions that will be raised in the aftermath of the G20.
Those kind of reforms on the hedge funds, that sort of thing, was what President Sarkozy of France and Chancellor Merkel of Germany wanted, and at least on paper they can go home and say, see, we finally got those Americans to agree to do this. President Obama went there to say, look, we've got to get these reluctant Europeans to stimulate their economies. That's what they need to do. They don't want to do it. if they agreed to do that?
Well, they've all committed to do stimulation as it's needed. And the question is, no one made a commitment to do more. The issue is very complex because, in fact, the effective level of stimulation in the United States is much less than meets the eye, because while the federal government is stimulating, about a third of all public expenditures are done at the state and local level, and the states are engaged in contraction. The states have a balanced budget framework, which means that when their tax revenues go down, they have to cut back expenditures or raise taxes, which is just the opposite of a stimulus. California alone, we know, did about $40 billion of this contractionary fiscal policy. The nation as a whole probably somewhere between $150 or $200 billion or more. So that is undoing the effect of the fiscal stimulus in the U.S. So the Europeans can look at the U.S. and say, yes, you say that you're doing stimulus, but you have a federal structure, and looking at it overall, you really aren't doing very much.
Now, we're talking with economist Joseph Stiglitz at Columbia University, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. After a couple of days of talks, people are talking about an historic agreement, a turnaround at the G20 meeting in London. Is this important? Does it matter? Let's go to Pepter. Pepter with us from Flint, Michigan.
It's Peter.
Peter.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Professor Stiglitz, I loved your book. I actually took a class on it in college.
Thank you.
But I don't think that the G20 does matter as much as it would 30 years ago, because I think a lot of the power in the world right now is situated with a kind of transnational elite, and those aren't just world leaders, but they're business leaders, leaders of NGOs, certain things like that. It's just not centered in states, and I think that the G20 kind of misses that.
Well, I think you raise an important point, but there's something on the other side, which is that globalization has made the countries of the world more integrated, so that what happens in one poor part of the global system really has many, much more ramifications elsewhere in the system. This is a global crisis, and I really do agree with the sentiment of the G20 that if we're going to get over this crisis, we have to have a global response. And unfortunately, the framing of the response, the decisions about the response, are going to remain at the national level. And each country is going to be focusing on the impact on their own citizens, looking at the cost and benefits to their own citizens. They'll look at the cost, the increase in the deficit and the national debt, the benefits, the increasing jobs in their own country. But in fact, we know that a stronger U.S. is going to create jobs outside the U.S. A stronger Europe is going to create jobs in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so if they take into account better how national policies have effects outside the boundaries, we'll get a much stronger recovery. And a particular aspect of this that's extraordinarily important is protectionism, efforts to make sure that the spending is concentrated at home will, of course, backfire. But unfortunately, after the last meeting in November in Washington of the G20, where they all made these high-sounding commitments not to engage in protectionism, 17 of the 20 went home and did it, including the United States, where we put a Buy America provision in our stimulus bill.
Peter, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you for talking to me.
Okay. As we've been talking about the United States and Europe, other big players in the world, too, at this economic summit, China and Japan, numbers 2 and 3 economies in the world. And I was going to ask, they are much bigger players at this meeting than we hardly ever talk about them, except for the Chinese these days.
That's right. And that's an example of a change in the global, you might say, global economic architecture, the balance of powers. Right now, the United States is, quite frankly, very dependent on the fact that a lot of our national debt is held by China. And China has raised the question, how confident can we be that you won't inflate away the value of the money that China has lent to us. And given the increase in the national debt, given the blowing up of the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, it's certainly understandable why there are those anxieties. The Federal Reserve comes back and say, don't worry, we'll manage the situation. Yes, deflation is the problem today, but in the future, the economy may recover, and when it does, inflation will be a could be a problem, but we'll take out that excess liquidity out of the system as it's needed. The problem is that anybody who has watched the management of the Federal Reserve, by the Federal Reserve of the U.S. economy cannot have much confidence. We've seen how the Fed has been really very bad in macroeconomic management. That's part of the reason we got into the mess. And so I think it's certainly understandable why there is that concern and why China said we need to have a new global reserve system.
Not the dollar, and here's a question on that from Mark in Frankfort, Kentucky. What effect would a true international currency such as China proposed have? What would be the pros and cons? And we'll give you a minute to answer.
It's really hard. But the real point is it would create mean a much more stable global economy. The problem is that currently the world is very dependent on the dollar. The dollar has been very volatile. It's not a good store of value. It depends, obviously, on economic policies in the United States, which can vary. Some years we have good management. Some years we have very bad management. Reliance on a global reserve system that would be diversified over all the countries of the world would, in that sense, be far more stable and therefore provide a sounder basis for the global financial system.
We're talking with economist Joseph Stiglitz, professor at Columbia University, the author of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, and the recipient of the Nobel Prize. Today's G20 meeting will generate plenty of congratulations among world leaders, already has. No shortage of headlines, too. But does it really matter? Is it important or not? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today's G20 summit in London came in response to the worst global economic downturn since the Great Depression. Speaking about an hour ago, President Obama said he was proud of what the meeting accomplished, but added that the agreements alone are not enough. Our focus this hour is what the U.S. really wants and needs from the G20. Does the G20 matter? Our guest is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia University. He headed President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation underway at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And also with us now is Lee Hudson Teslick. He's an associate editor at the Council on Foreign Affairs. He's been analyzing the G20 meeting for CFR, and he joins us from their studios in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And you wrote a terrific piece about what each of these players going in, the G20, was looking to get out of this, what they'd said about what they wanted and what they actually wanted, looking at the preliminary results as people issue statements following the conclusion of today's meetings, how'd they do? First of all, why don't we talk about, the United States, for one.
Sure. Well, if you look back a week ago, the United States and even further back was really emphasizing the stimulus question, as you mentioned before. This wasn't brought up as loudly at the summit. My sense is that over the last couple of days, that Barack Obama sensed that he wasn't going to be able to get the kind of agreement that he would have wanted or the kinds of sounds coming out of Germany or France or Russia that he would have wanted on that point. And that, therefore, kept it kind of quiet so that it wouldn't look like this summit was a failure on that account.
Going as a listener rather than a lecturer, that's what he had to say about that. Were Germany, France, and Russia then able to get the kind of concessions on financial regulations from the United States that they wanted?
Well, it depends how you look at things. France, it seems like the OECD is going to be releasing basically a list of tax havens, the goal of which will be to identify places where essentially companies or people can operate outside of financial regulation that a country like France or a country like the United States would want to implement. If you're talking about setting up a global regulatory structure that actually has significant teeth, then no, it's still going to be U.S. You know, the United States will still be responsible for the U.S. financial regulatory structure, and France will still be responsible for the French financial regulatory structure.
Is this the end of bank secrecy?
What might come of this? There was an agreement to establish a new, what they're calling a financial stability board, which is essentially a new iteration of the financial stability forum. You might at follow-up meetings get statements about essentially setting out guidelines for best practices for bank regulation. So there could be agreement, future agreements on this. That's we'll have to see.
China?
China had several goals going into this summit, with a sort of overarching one is to establish itself as a larger player in the international system. The increase of money to the IMF that we saw today is a significant increase of money, and it will serve well to prevent, some countries defaulting on their debt in the short term. But what's really, if you're looking more long term and in sort of a rebalancing of the global economy, the kinds of discussions that are going to be necessary will still have to get China more involved. I mean, what a lot of analysts are saying, looking at this, is they're even questioning why the G20 is the forum for this discussion, saying that a G2 or with the United States and China, or a G3 that loops in Europe, might actually be more appropriate if you're talking about a sort of global grand bargain that rebalances China's power.
That's interesting. But Joseph Stiglitz, if you have the G2 or G3, you're going to have a political problem because the rest of the world is affected by this.
That's right. In fact, there's a lot of unhappiness, I can tell you, in the rest of the world about the G20 on the other grounds, that it's not representative enough, it's not inclusive enough, and it doesn't lack – it lacks political legitimacy. I think that there's going forward need to be discussions at many different levels. I think that the some of them will obviously have to be done at a bilateral level. But in the end, the important decisions in today's world have to be done in a more inclusive way.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is John. John with us from Detroit.
I think it's very important that we listen to the G20. Sarkozy's threat of walking out if we don't get our corporations more under control is, and I believe he was talking also wanted to talk about executive compensation, whereas you have the Boston Globe reporting that the Japanese pay their corporate executives approximately 10 times more than the person on the floor. U.S. companies, the top 350 companies, their CEOs receive an average of 279 times the average yearly wage of the person on the floor. That is ridiculous, and I agree with Sarkozy. These things need to be gotten under control.
By regulation, do you think, John?
By regulation, whatever it takes. I mean, I'm the biggest capitalist in the world, but if we don't get these things under control, as far as I'm concerned, we're seeing Karl Marx's prophecy come true.
Can I say there are two problems? One of them is a problem of corporate governance that this reflects, that we don't have the simplistic kind of capitalism that many people have in mind, where you have an owner of the firm and the owner makes decisions for his own benefit. And what we have is firms that are controlled by people other than their owners. There's a separation between ownership and control, and that's what leads to these outrageous kinds of compensation schemes. But where it becomes really important is when it comes to the financial institutions that have become too big to fail. And it's not just the level of compensation, it's the form of the compensation, a form of compensation that encourages short-sighted behavior, excessive risk-taking, where the American taxpayer winds up picking up the losses. And that's the area where I think regulation is absolutely essential, because if you have incentives to behave badly, one of the things economics tells us is that people do respond to incentives, and they have. And what has happened should be viewed as intolerable.
John, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to this is Whitney. Whitney from Moorhead in Minnesota.
Hello. I think protectionism can be a good thing, too. Life ends goods halfway around the world. At its base level, it's much more inefficient than selling goods within a country because of the cost and resources used in transportation. I mean, some countries have poor labor laws, environmental laws, low currency value. This is why a company might locate halfway around the world just to sell back to its own country. I mean, it might for tax reasons. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons that this is done, and none of them have anything to do with efficiency because, like I said, it's much. I don't understand why it's so important to fling goods all the way around the world. And I mean, it's sometimes protectionism can save a country from destruction. I mean, there's some of these small countries that just can't take
While you're looking for it, Whitney, I just want to hope that you're doing well, given the flood conditions that you have up there in Moorhead, Minnesota. But Joseph Stiglitz, he's got a. Are other people in the world you're fearing protectionism? There are a lot of people like Whitney who said, "Wait a minute, maybe this is overblown."
Well, I think what people are worried about right now is the fact that. There could be a replay of what happened in the 1930s where many countries engaged in what we call beggar thy neighbor policies to protect their citizens and to help their economy. They put up tariff barriers and then those in other countries did the same. And as that happened, global trade decreased and everybody got worse off. So the issue is, will that happen this time? Right now, the problem is not so much direct protectionism, tariffs of the kind we had back in the 30s, but indirect protectionism, sometimes legal protectionism, sometimes not quite consistent with WTO laws. For instance, the United States in its stimulus package had a provision called Buy America, and then they said, but we won't apply the provision when it violates WTO rules.
International agreements. Obligations, I think is what it said, yeah.
That's right. But the interesting thing is we have those international obligations with other advanced industrial countries, but typically we don't have them with poor countries. So that provision was a provision that said while the developing countries are the innocent victims, we aren't going to allow America to buy from poor countries that don't have these agreements, of which there are very many. So it was really discriminating against the poor. And that's the kind of protectionism that I think of is unfair and actually doesn't build goodwill. I can tell you the kind of resentment that I hear as I travel in the developing world.
Yeah. I just wanted to get Lee Hudson Teslick back into the conversation at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Lee, as you were doing this survey and looking at what various people wanted, again, this goes beyond the big countries we were talking about. Is there any talk of protectionism as their way out, this beggar thy neighbor policy that Joseph Stiglitz was talking about?
Well, there is absolutely. This is one of the major concerns for some of the smaller players at this summit, whether countries that trade a lot with the United States, from Canada to Mexico to India, to countries that trade more with China, such as Australia or Indonesia or Japan or South Korea. This has arisen as a major concern that essentially a big trading partner could implement new tariffs that would really do a number on their economies.
Yet there are going to be protectionist elements, not just even within the European Union. This is supposed to be an organization that is structured around knocking down trade barriers, and yet you have big divisions between some of the newer members, the Baltic states, Poland, that sort of thing, and France and Germany.
Right. And it's actually one of the more interesting questions we're going to see coming out of this financial crisis is how the European Union responds. As you mentioned, there are some the crisis has really hit Eastern Europe very, very hard. Some of the countries there, their economies were focused, quite narrowly around finance and around the financial sector. And now they're really feeling pretty serious pain, and they're turning to Western Europe for help. And one of the questions that will be answered over the next few years is the extent to which Western Europe is willing to help, the extent to which they're willing to abide by sort of agreements they had made going into the EU, or whether this crisis will weaken the EU.
Lee Hudson-Teslick, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Lee Hudson-Teslick, Associate Editor at the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us today from their studios in New York City. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Joseph Stiglitz, a couple of minutes ago, you were saying, well, eventually this may recover and the economy may start to grow again. There are people in this country talking today that the economy may have bottomed out and may be back on its way up. We've seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average on a steady increase over the past month or so. Today, up 278 points, over 8,000, and factory orders up for the last month. And people are saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe these are crocuses. Maybe things are beginning to turn around.
Well, stock market always is very volatile. As an economist, I'm a little bit more pessimistic. There obviously are going to be good signs and bad signs. During the Great Depression, there were many of these kinds of false starts. One of the things that's likely to happen tomorrow when the data comes out in jobs, it's likely to be a large number of more people joining the ranks of their unemployed. The more fundamental problem that we have to keep in mind is that what sustained the U.S. economy for several years before this crisis was unsustainable debt. Americans were living beyond their means. American households were borrowing. National savings rate plummeted to zero. The likelihood is that, especially as their wealth has been wiped out and people realize that they were foolish, they were assuming the house prices would go up and up. In fact, they've come down. Is that they'll save more. Good for the long run, but very bad for the short run. Savings rates have already increased from, you know, 0 to 5-6%, and people are expecting them to continue to go up. And that means that there will be an insufficiency of aggregate demand with weak consumption, with weak exports because of the global slowdown, with weak investment. Investment is not going to be strong as long as consumption and exports are weak. It's hard to have a strong economy. And so, yes, there'll be blips up and blips down, but it's going to be a while before we have, I think, a sustainable and robust recovery.
Let's get one last caller in. This is Jay calling us from Orlando.
Hi, Neil, and I wanted to thank you for taking my call. I think most Americans would agree that the G20 is absolutely crucial. We no longer have an isolated economy. Basically, if the economies of all nations don't prosper, we can't trade. The cash doesn't flow. Currency doesn't flow. But what I have a problem with, and this is like a two-part comment and perhaps a question, is I'm sitting here trying to deal with my home, about to foreclose in a few months. I have to let it foreclose because I got into a lot of credit card debt, like your guest was saying, and it was an optimistic time, but I couldn't afford when my mortgage went up to pay both my credit cards and my mortgage. But these credit card companies sell your debts, and then collectors start coming after you. They threaten to garnish your wages, freeze your checking account. And now, in order to have the money to fight that off or to defend myself, I have to let my house go so that I have extra money.
And we're sorry to hear you're in that situation, Jay, but we just have a very little time left, so if there's a question.
Yeah, the question is, what happened to the promise to repeal the anti-bankruptcy laws of the Bush administration?
Is that in the cards, do you think, Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, the banks who got us into this mess are still politically powerful, and they are still resisting that. Let me agree with the questioner. absolutely essential that we do something about a repeal of the bankruptcy laws that were passed in the Bush years. They actually contributed to this downturn, this crisis, in several ways. One of them was they encouraged bad lending because the banks believed that they could use the power that they had to squeeze out the money out of poor borrowers and uninformed borrowers and borrowers who didn't understand what they were getting into. So I think it's absolutely essential. This should be high on the political agenda.
Joseph Stiglitz, thanks very much for your time today, as always. Joseph
Thank
Stiglitz,
you.
A professor of economics at Columbia University. His latest book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. When we come back, we'll talk with the director of a new film. This is NPR News.